I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold.
This week, we're speaking with Nimmo Bassi, an environmental and human rights activist working out of Nigeria. Nimmo has been involved in countless environmental advocacy groups, including Friends of Earth International, Environmental Rights Action, and the Health of Mother Earth Foundation.
We want to learn about the particular environmental challenges that Africa is facing and what it will take to transform the extractive economies ravaging the continent and our planet.
Here's Nimmo.
I am Nimmo Bassi. I direct Health of Mother Earth Foundation, which is an ecological think tank based in Nigeria. We're based in Nigeria, but Africa is our focus. No, I should just warn you that where I am is quite noisy, so you could hear honking from the street probably. And sometimes some sirens, the military will be passing by. So if you hear that, nothing to worry about, it's just noise. We are very concerned with injustices built by through exploitation of natural resources, colonization, and the reign of transnational corporations who have absolutely destroyed most of our environments through the extractive industry, as well as now making inroads through our food systems. So our concern is about environmental justice, and we work on three broad areas. The first is fossil politics, which covers climate issues, as well as all the issues related to environmental pollution, particularly from the extractive and fossil fuel sector. We also work on hunger politics because we believe that people are not hungry for lack of food. They're hungry because of the forces controlling access to food and all the social inequalities in our society. We equally have another track we call Ikike. Ikike is a Nigerian word found in two Nigerian languages, which speaks mostly about knowledge and about the right to hold our views and to share our knowledge and what we believe is right. But before now, I wasn't always an environmentalist. I started life as a young adult, was very clear about social issues. And so I was more or less a social activist. Then from there, I moved on to be a human rights activist. At the time, Nigeria was under military rule, and there was very rampant human rights abuses. At a point, I found that some of the things we're demanding for were too basic, because we're campaigning for better prison conditions. We're campaigning for people not to be arrested for just any cause. Then I found that what was really fundamental to us was the abuses related to environmental rights. And so I began to work on environmental human rights issue, which is where I still am now. And I was most inspired by the late Ken Salawiwa, who was a Nigerian environmentalist, foremost Nigerian environmental justice activist and minority rights activist, who was wrongfully was murdered by the Nigerian state on 10th of November, 1995. And it was his activism that completely changed my understanding about how we have to defend our people, how to have to work with our people, how we have to follow the leadership of our people. And that still inspires me today. Whenever my energy level is low, he's from Ogoniland. When my energy level is low, I go to Ogoniland. It's like a pilgrimage to me. I sit down there, look at the pollution, then I understand that the job is not done, that the forces that have pushed us to where we are now are still active, that we cannot give up.
So, Nimmo, what are the industries that are ravaging Africa? And can you just give us some specific examples of what you're talking about? Because we can only see it in videos, and it's great to hear your description.
Yes. I mentioned fossil politics and hunger politics. So I'll give you first the fossil politics. The transnational corporations who have ravaged the Nigerian environment for over six decades is led, the whole, the league is led by Shell Oil Company. You have also ExxonMobil, you have Chevron, you have Total, you have Eni. All the oil majors are right here in Niger Delta, contaminating the environment in ways that you cannot describe. For between 2018 and 2019, the official National Oil Spills Detection and Response Agency announced that there were 1,300 oil spills, on an average of 5 oil spills a day. And so we're speaking about the Niger Delta being one of the 10 top most polluted places on planet Earth. And because of the depth of pollution from the oil industry, both through oil spills and gas flaring. Gas flaring are giant gas furnaces that are burning in oil fields associated with crude oil extraction. They're burning 24 hours a day, and they've been going on for decades in the middle of big communities. So life expectancy in the Niger Delta is 41 years. Nationally, Nigeria has one of the lowest life expectancy at 54 or so years. But in Niger Delta, when you go to some communities and look for elders, you're going to see fairly young people coming out as elders. And some of us, I'm from Niger Delta, I'm much older than that, so I'm one of the living ancestors. Now, the food sector is being challenged by genetic engineering, seeds being introduced by Monsanto, which has now been bought by Bayer. But they're still here as Monsanto Nigeria, Agriculture Nigeria. And all those who have a lot of seeds being, not just crops being approved for cultivation, but also grains being imported for the feed industry. So we're having a lot of these corporations, including those who are producing agricultural herbicides, including, again, to Monsanto. Roundup Ready is all over Nigeria. It's not being regulated. It's approved. Actually, has approval number stamped all over it. And so we have a big challenge getting our regulators to understand that these chemicals used by farmers who are not even reading the directions, who are not taking care to wear protective gears, they are exposing themselves to these carcinogens. And then the challenge with this is, again, is that if a herbicide is a possible carcinogen, why should I spread that on a crop I'm going to eat? These are some of the challenges we're having. And yeah, so those are some of the big polluters that we have here. And I believe that all they're doing here, they may think they're doing business, but they're actually committing crimes.
And so when you move forward with your advocacy, what specifically are you trying to accomplish? Is it a legal structure or enforcement or getting the corporations to be more responsible? How do you go about your work?
Now, that's a complex question. And I would say that also that we face a complex situation, so we approach it from many dimensions. Our work is not unidirectional. And so we're tackling it from all kinds of directions. And our basic, in terms of fossil fuels, our campaign has been that it should leave the oil in the ground. We are totally against oil extraction because all we see is destruction. We don't see any, I don't personally see any gain from it. Today I was reading a news item about somebody campaigning against activists in Mozambique, which is in southeastern Africa. Those who are campaigning against natural gas development. There's some companies telling the government they're going to gain income of $25 billion, $50 billion over 25 years, which comes to about $2 billion every year. And I'm asking, am I going to mortgage my future, my very life, my survival, my livelihood, my environment for $2 billion a year for a whole nation? It's not worth it at all. But in terms of Nigeria, now, after so many years of contamination, we've had many legal cases, litigation in courts in Nigeria, courts in Europe, in North America, and all these have not really yielded much. Whenever the corporations feel they're going to lose the case, they settle out of court. So settling out of court with community people, with victims, doesn't really address the issues because they just make some payments and then that case is put under the radar. Meanwhile, they are committing the same offense over and over again. So, but we do understand that litigation is a good strategy. Litigation, especially outside of Nigeria, because they don't pay much attention to what happens here. And so we have to work with allies to challenge them in their home countries, where shareholders would ask questions, where is this profit coming from? Is it really that what happens to the communities where you are extracting these resources? And then we are most concerned also about changing people's, getting people to re-examine our imagination. So we're challenging coloniality, which is the mentality that brought in a lot of basic principles that I see driving the economic system. The colonial ecology of plantation agriculture, of growing things for cash and not for seeing food as a commodity, not as a celebration, not as culture, not as life. We are working on getting people to have these conversations and to have dialogue with nature. How do we live? What does well-being mean? What does it mean that I'm living well? What does it mean to say that I'm having a good life? And we have many notions in Africa about what a good life is, about what well-being is. And it's not about how much money you have. It's not about how wealthy you are. It's not about how much property you've accumulated. It's about how you relate to nature, how you relate to your neighbor, how you are in community. And that is where the South African concept of Ubuntu is very important. I am because you are. My being is connected to your being. And then we have also notions like Harambe, East Africa in Swahili, meaning cooperative, pulling together, working together. In my language, which is Ibibio. Now we have over 500 languages in Nigeria because we have a lot to say. So we need many languages. You can imagine that. So in my language, living well is called Etiuwem. Etiuwem is also the title of my blog, where I write about social issues. It's about well-being. It's about how you relate to your neighbor. What's your name? How do people see you? It's not about only how you see yourself. How do you situate yourself? And the whole essence of all this is to get us to the root of the challenges facing us. What is the future that we're looking at? What is the pathways to take us to that future? Where are we now? What put us where we are now? Can we reinvent the past? Can we go, is our future our past? Or must we take off from where we are now and ensure that we don't destroy the pathways to the future? And I was chatting with somebody today and he talked about, he said, change must not be an inevitable deterioration of the present. And I think this is very, very important. So you don't just tell me technology can solve all the problems. Technology will not solve all the problems. But technology is moving so fast, you can't even regulate technology at the moment. And we are concerned about these extinction technologies, which are making inroads to Africa. And we are very worried it may come to Nigeria. And of course, climate technology and engineering, which could give more powers to those who are already powerful and push all the harms to those who are already vulnerable and victims.
I want to go back to something you said about shareholder awareness. So what is the tactic, though? Like, if we were to join your effort to change shareholders' minds, is the movement to divest one of the movements you're involved in, or how do you influence shareholder decision making?
Now, our work is not really very complete or effective. We don't have allies, so we have groups in the global north who are seriously engaged in this. And the strategies for campaigning is quite sometimes very different from the global north and the global south, because there are different ways of reaching people. In the north, shareholder activism is very effective. So some of our campaigners do attend those meetings, and maybe they hold shares. I have one share in Shell, for example, so I could possibly go to their shareholder meeting, but I never attended it. I didn't intend to attend it. But I like to receive those books to know what they're making. So that's the way we work. We're working. And some, you know, we have, the thing is this, that citizens in the global north are mostly very much in solidarity with citizens in the global south. The disconnect is between the industry and the governments and the people and the citizens. And this is where we're suffering all these impacts. If we can solve the corporations and solve the issue of government, I think we'll have a better world.
That's a very big challenge. Like, if we can solve the issue of government, what does that look like exactly?
Yes, if we can solve the government, we'll have a lot of peace in the world. Because, you know, one of the things that we look at, every year, before the year begins, myself and my colleagues, we gather together to review our history and to review the history of our challenges and where we want to go. And we always remind ourselves where transnational corporations began to afflict us, because they are like predators. And they precede colonialism. They were the first to colonize territories. It was when it became less profitable for them to use their mercenaries or their private armies, they handed over territories to imperial powers. And then the kings and the queens and the politicians began to exert authority on behalf of the corporations. And right now, so the corporation willfully handed over to governments to colonize on their behalf. And the colonial policies were about plantations and extractions and everything, negating the local needs, but promoting whatever will be taken over for the metropolis or for the home base. And today, it's still the same thing. The governments in the global north are actually ruling on behalf of corporations, because they make economic demands on nations, forcing nations to accept certain things. Countries were forced to accept the Copenhagen Accord, for example, which was rejected by many countries. Otherwise, if they didn't accept it, then they would get economic aid. Some countries were forced to accept genetically modified seeds, otherwise they wouldn't get economic aid. This is completely immoral.
Oh. Yeah, when you said, when you described the oil extraction, and it's a lot of oil spills you were describing. I got goosekin, you know, because it's actually, I have a physical reaction to what you were, when you were describing it. And, it's taking away a birthright, from us if we are destructing or polluting the earth. And that is, exactly, I guess, what's happening in Nigeria. And it's huge. You basically, big corporations are using the land as a junkyard. And I wonder why there is, I mean, maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, but is there really so little awareness in the West what is going on in Nigeria? And why is, I mean, we're in 2020, you know, all of Africa, it's not just Nigeria, I guess, right? Why is there finally not like a huge change?
This is the question, exactly the question. The West is well aware of the situation. Most countries have embassies in Nigeria, and most ambassadors visit. Some of them are going with some of them to the Niger Delta. They're very much aware, and they go. So they're fully aware. I think at this point is willful blindness. It's a decision to look at what is going on as though it was normal. A few weeks ago, there was an oil spill in Mauritius. You heard about the ship that broke up and polluted the coral reefs and contaminated the coastal waters. The whole world woke up to that. I'm living in West Africa, I was getting calls. Now, how can we support, destroy the people in Mauritius to clean up the spill? But that was just once. That's like a drop in the ocean, literally. I mean, I don't want one drop of oil can contaminate 1 million drops of water. So that's the ratio. And that is really crazy. So when you have a situation where you have the equivalent of Exxon Valdez happening every year for over 60 years in one place, in one community, one region, one word to describe it is ecocide. It's like the world has given up on us. The world has given up on our territory. And our governments are just interested in the dollars. They're interested in the petrol dollars. That's all, nothing more. And so when you have this kind of situation, it's like a global, local and global conspiracy to consign the people of the Niger Delta to the worst possible living conditions. We are forgotten people. We're shouting and screaming. I wrote a poem called, we thought it was oil. I write poetry anyway. We thought it was oil, but it was blood. The last few stanzas is, we are placed where they're living, long sacrificed. placed on the slab, slaughtered every day, were a living, long sacrifice. We thought it was oil, but it was blood. That, to me, sums it up. But there's hope. We're not giving up.
Yeah, but there seems to be a huge disconnect, right? I mean, you talk about the interconnectedness of the communities and celebrating of food. And I think there are movements in the West who are actually exactly trying to rediscover that, right? We had an interview with permaculture, eco-villages. You know, a lot of people, I think, are waking up to the sort of Mother Earth connection and celebration of life and celebration of especially food and having clean water, birthrights. And then there seems to be a huge disconnect when it then comes to, oh yeah, I mean, at the other hand, we have the oil distraction and what you talked about, the seeds thing. Yeah, a huge disconnect from that. So how do we bridge this? How do we overcome it? How do you connect?
I think the route towards that, and that connection is the hope that we have. It's a future that we see. It's what makes us keep going on. Otherwise, we would easily give up. Because the problems will look so overwhelming, but we believe in the resiliency of humans are very resilient. Nature itself, herself, is very resilient. And nature has been very patient on us. And so we see that there are movements in the global north. People who are working with us, obviously. There are people sharing ideas, there are people who are sharing inspiration, sharing hopes, and of course, sharing the pains also. So we see these struggles coming up across the whole world, and what we're doing is to try to connect and bring this to a big global force. That is the fight for the rights of nature. We have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but what about nature? If nature is harmed, it harms us, harms our right to live, the right to life. There's no right to life in a polluted environment. There's no right to life in contaminated food. So we, all these forces are coming together, but they have different names. So you have different names and different ways to describe what to do, but they're all the same thing. So this is the hope that everything will come together, everything is evolving together, and one day we'll all march on the streets together.
What do you see as a future? How could we create a roadmap for people, for Nigeria and also for Africa as a whole?
I think it has to be a roadmap for the whole world, because Africa would never be in isolation. Although we're accessible we're already accessible from by water, surrounded, totally surrounded by water, almost like Australia, just that we're not so distant from other people. But I do understand that we can begin to do things in our countries, in our communities and territories. And already some territories are showing examples of what can be done. So I believe that we would first of all have to all agree that we have to live within limits. The planet is not things on the planet are not inexhaustible. The African Union recently said that the blue economy would open a way of new development pathway for Africa because the resources of the seas are limitless. And that is a lie. Resources in the oceans are not limitless. There's nothing on planet Earth that is not limited. Everything is limited. The planet itself is limited. So having that understanding is the first hurdle that we have to cross. And then agreeing that we don't need more than what we need individually, and that we can share things, more of the sharing economy, more of looking, building the fabric of society. What has kept communities surviving now is up to this point, despite all the assault, is the basic fabric that is self-reinforcing, that families work together, communities support one another, that we look out for one another. The future will be less of individualism, but more of collectivity. This is the way, because even if I'm dancing and I enjoy my dance, unless somebody tells me I'm dancing well, I don't really enjoy my dance. that sounds like a joke, but it's true. Somebody has to tell me, Nemo, you are dancing well. Then I really enjoy the dance. If I'm just dancing alone, I could think maybe I'm crazy. Just dancing alone, what's that for? dancing without music. That's crazy. So we have to be collective, we have to work together. And the whole thing, as I said, we have to consider that we are not the only beings on planet Earth. otherwise wouldn't bother to call ourselves human beings. There are other beings, both visible and invisible, and they all have a right to live. They have a right to thrive. The soil itself is filled with millions of organisms, millions of living beings. And so we need to take care of everything. Take care of the soil takes care of us. If we take care of the soil, take care of the water, let's have biodiversity and life, actual life. And we should win ourselves of the thinking that we can make nature more efficient. Nature is already efficient. The webs of life are so intricate, and we don't fully understand the intricacies of life. We don't even know how many organisms live inside us and give us the energy that we have to speak and to communicate and to do things. And so we need a level of humility. We need to humble ourselves that there's a lot we don't know, and there's a lot we have to trust Mother Earth to do for us, and that we have to understand that we're stamping too hard on Mother Earth, and that if we destroy the soil, we're destroying ourselves. Destroy the air, destroying ourselves. Take over the sky, we're actually taking the roof away from our homes. And one Nigerian proverb says, the son that burns the father's house or the mother's home will inherit nothing but ashes. And that's what we're doing to the planet. And what do we want to inherit? The ashes.
So how can people, wherever they are, whether here in the United States or in Europe, or in Africa, how can they support you? What would you like them to support you?
Okay. First of all, we feel highly supported when people pay attention to what is happening and to what we're saying, what we're doing, and also sharing with us the ideas of sharing with us what they're doing also, so that we can actually work together. And these days, it's very easy to, online, we don't need to travel to be together, we can be together as we are now, online. And so we just, it's by building the connections and letting us share our stories and learn new ways of doing things together. Also amplifying the stories that we are bringing out and making those who are involved in creating the harms that are causing, making life almost impossible, to know that what they're doing is actually immoral and criminal.
Is there any question, Nimmo, we haven't asked you, you would have liked us to ask you?
You know, we can never finish this in one conversation. If we had time, I would have read a poem, but I don't think we have that time.
No, yes, read a poem.
Oh, please.
Read a poem.
Okay, I'll read one poem. I wrote this poem in 2010 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, during the People's Summit on Climate Change and the Right of Mother Earth. It's called "I Will Not Dance to Your Beat." I will not dance to your beat if you call plantations forest. I will not dance to your beat. I will not sing with you if you privatize my water. I will not dance to your beat. I will confront you with my fist if climate change means death to me but business to you. I will not dance to your beat. I will expose your evil greed if you don't leave crude oil in the soil, coal in the hole, and tar sands in the land. I will not dance to your beat. I will confront you and denounce you if you insist on carbon offsetting and other do-nothing false solutions. I will not dance to your beat. I will stand against you if you remain a climate outlaw. I will not dance to your beat. If you push forest communities away from their land, I will not dance to your beat. I will drag you to the International Criminal Court if you commit ecocide on the altar of profit. I will not dance to your beat. If you care nothing about the earth, humans, and other beings, I will not dance to your beat. I'll make you drink your own medicine if you fight against Mother Earth and set mirrors in the sky to mask the sun. I will not dance to your beat. I will not dance to your beat unless we walk the sustainable path. I will not dance to your beat unless you accept real solutions and respect Mother Earth. I will not dance to your beat. Unless you do, I will not, and we will not, dance to your beat.
Beautiful.
Gooskin again. Yeah. Thank you, Nimmo.
Thank you so much. Wow. It's hard to not feel depressed at the description of what's going on. And we all know in the back of our minds that Africa struggles.
Yes, we know that Africa is struggling, but we made them struggle. I think the West has always considered Africa, like we've always outsourced things there. We've taken from Africa and we've dumped stuff there.
Right? Yeah, it's humanity's dark closet.
And in particular, the oil thing, like we in the West depend on oil. Like what would happen in the US if we switched off the oil tap? A catastrophe. What would happen to our food industry, to our way of life? Unimaginable. So we basically base our lifestyle still, I mean, we could do it very differently, on the destruction and exploitation of what is going on in Nigeria. And they're all there, you know, he named it Shell, Total, you know, all those. And yes, probably know it. Africa has been struggling, but we are part of the struggle.
Oh, I'm not saying we're 100% the cause of the struggle. The question is, you know, making those connections that he's talking about, having people really get that we are creating that problem. And as he said, we will end up with ashes.
I think this is very much what we discussed in the interview with Rights of Nature and Pachamama. And it's about this waking up from our Western dream. That there is this disconnect, right? That we have established our life and our lifestyle and our industry and actually also food systems and all of that on top of other people. Exploitations. And Mother Earth. And as he points out, it's a one-way street leading us to complete destruction. How do you call it when something goes worse and worse and worse? It's like for me, it's like an avalanche. No, you start and you can't really stop it anymore. It just goes downhill.
For an American, it is very difficult. We see these pictures of poor kids on television and stuff like that. But it's really difficult to see that as a lived reality that we created. And I think really getting that, you know, getting that, can even speaking to Nimmo, like, makes a connection that we wouldn't have otherwise had, where he's describing what's going on. And it's shocking. Even though I already know what's going on, it's shocking to have someone living that experience and communicating what it's like.
Like when he laughs, you know, you feel this really wow. This, there's a resonance there and there is life inside him, which is fantastic. I can feel like how he said he's dancing and the livelihood the joy, he said celebration of food and the joy within the communities. And it's maybe where I see a lot of hope, because there is, once you experience this within your community and you experience what good food is like and how valuable it is to actually have clean water and food and a community, you don't want to give it up anymore. You don't want to give it up even for the dollars. And I hope the next generation is deciding for the well-being and not going for the dollars. We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore. Thanks for listening.